Hello, hello. Welcome to the House Einstein podcast. This is podcast 26. I am your host, Osman Parvez with House Einstein, and I am a realtor here in Boulder, Colorado. Our business covers Denver, Boulder, some of the mountain resort towns. We have a handful of agents on the team, and I've been doing this about 20 years. Prior to real estate, I was in the investment community and did a lot of analytical things in the investment world. And with me is Hamish Crabb.
Hello, hello. I'm Hamish Crabb, and I've been with House Einstein for 21 months now, still. And I help keep the brokerage running smoothly. I take care of marketing tasks, help agents with showings, and help with contracts as well. So happy to be here.
And Hamish is part of every deal I do and has had quite the exposure to the real estate world. I don't know why you're counting your tenure in months like it's a newborn baby, but I'll take it.
Yeah. In the last podcast, I said I'd get down to days, but I didn't. So we're still at 21 months, but maybe we'll move into years once we hit 2 years.
Okay. Well, I'm over 240 months.
Nice. That's great.
It's still learning. It's still learning. Quick disclaimer, this podcast is entertainment. If you are a House Einstein client, please call us, email us, text us for advice on your specific real estate situation. For everyone else listening, this 100% is to be treated as entertainment, and that keeps the attorneys happy. Do not take this as real estate, legal, professional, spiritual, or relationship advice. Sound good?
Definitely cover not it. Spiritual advice. Yep.
To the point.
Agreed. I need to in add this... one more point to our show notes. I'm sorry. It's an easy one. For it.
Okay. We can hear you typing, but that's okay.
Good.
All right. So in this podcast, we're going to be covering some of the latest stuff that's happening in the news. We are currently recording this on November 16th, 2023, and we are still playing catch up with our publication schedule. This should go live the week after Thanksgiving. In which case, actually, we should wish you or ask about or hope that you had a fantastic Thanksgiving. And if you didn't, then hopefully you had a great Black Friday and scored some deals. But we certainly hope you had a fun time with friends, family, and yourself, of course.
Well said.
Yeah. we used to have a Friendsgiving when I first moved to Boulder. My ex and I, and I've stopped doing Friendsgivings, but it was sort of an orphan's Thanksgiving. Anyone that wasn't leaving town and didn't have a place to go were welcome. And we had quite a few people that from disparate backgrounds at our house, and it was a fantastic tradition. Thanksgiving is my favorite holiday. It's the least commercial, followed by one of the most commercial events. But for 24 hours, we're not that commercial, which I really appreciate. It's all about breaking bread and getting together with your family and friends, colleagues, and just expressing gratitude.
Yeah, I completely agree. I actually haven't had a Friendsgiving yet, and kind of a missed opportunity this year, though we're still sort of settling into the home. And we don't quite have a dining room in this house, so maybe we'll have one next year. We'll see.
Yeah, I think we will. I would love to do it maybe a couple of weeks before Thanksgiving. That way people that are leaving town can go do their thing. The key becomes how many people can we host and how do we arrange it? But I really would like to make it happen. So that is on my agenda to bring that back for next year.
Well, since we naturally kind of slipped into the Thanksgiving talking point, turkey or ham, Osman?
Check my what?
A turkey or ham.
Oh, turkey for sure.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Wrong, but interesting.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's an interesting question, Hamish. Interesting question. Yeah. All right. Let me cover the rest of the things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about what's happening in the news. And we're going to touch on a couple of sales that have recently occurred, sales of the week. And we're going to be touching base on privacy matters in real estate, respecting sellers and buyers' privacy, and sometimes what the contract dictates, and also how that might affect negotiation. I'm going to make a note to not forget the negotiation piece. And then we'll wrap it up with a quick talk on some of our changes to our content that we're putting out, including the podcast and the newsletter and our other socials, and sort of our thinking behind how do we continue to produce and distribute great content and get it to you.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay.
I think we're going for a full length one today, aren't we?
We might cover the full hour. We didn't cover a topic last week, by the way, but we can hold that off and maybe visit it in podcast 27. So let's jump in. In the news, the equities markets have taken off. They have taken the bad news that, well, I don't know if it's bad news, but the slowing job market and decreasing inflationary numbers as indicative of positive news that the Fed is going to stop raising rates and will likely start dropping rates next year. And they are pricing that in. The S&P is up over 3% this week, and that is quite remarkable. It's driven by a few particular names, but it's the sentiment maybe has shifted. And that has implications for the real estate market, of course. If rates do start to drop, and let me back up for a second. When there's two different kinds, well, there's many kinds of rates, but if the yield curve starts to drop, if the discount rate, which sets the rate for the entire economic system, starts to drop, the 10-year note will drop, and so will the 30-year fixed rate mortgage, so will shorter duration mortgages, adjustable rates will drop, and will potentially start to wake up the housing market in the United States, across the country, but particularly in places where real estate is in high demand and inventory is low. And I paused when I said that because if you're a fan of House Einstein and you've read our you read our newsletter, which is going out tomorrow, I go into more specifics about what I anticipate seeing, as well as what we saw last month in the data, which includes much higher inventory, more listings hitting the market, in general slowing, but a little bit of a wake up last month in sales volume. So take a look at that for Boulder and Denver in the upcoming newsletter. It will be released tomorrow, November 17th, just in time for Thanksgiving.
It'll also be linked in the description below.
Yes. Also, so what do we expect to happen? It's not like a normal consumable housing in that you can potentially delay your purchase, perhaps like a durable good, like a car, right? You could potentially delay buying a car a year because rates are high, but people choose to buy or sell real estate largely around life events. And that's normal residential real estate. I'm not talking about commercial real estate, and I'm not talking about investment properties. I'm mostly talking about primary homes and secondary homes, and life events drive those. And life events don't wait for the stock market or the Fed. They just continue to happen. So divorces, marriages, household formation, deaths, estate transfers, job changes, juniors going to college, those things all happen irrespective, usually. I mean, there's some link with marriages and divorce, but usually they're going to happen whether or not rates are high or low. And so the housing need tends to back up. And I think of it, I just shared this morning, is like the Augustus Gloop effect from Willy Wonka. When you get a back pressure of buyers and sellers that have been holding off. And so the market can have an uncorking, so to speak, a rapid acceleration when rates are clearly signaling they're going to start dropping. So and all that delayed market activity will start to come to the forefront. So this is what's left of the fourth quarter. We're at the end of it. And well, I guess we're in the middle of it, but really, the market goes to bed by the second week of December. It's vacation time. We still do real estate deals, of course, but for the most part, most of the world is no longer focused on economic matters. Everyone's gift shopping, at least in the Western world, and there isn't a lot of market activity. But in January, it picks up, and this year could be quite a bit more activity than last year because of the market now starting to show signs of waking up.
Yeah, lots of pent-up demand. Rates being the gating factor for a lot of individuals.
Yep. So I personally have 4 listings in the queue. I know Sophie and Ian have deals they're working on. We have buyers coming into the market and everyone's preparing for January. So for buyers, that means seeing stuff now just so they can get their heads around neighborhoods. They don't, you know, this time of year is not great for inventory in general, although there's a lot more than last year. It's still the dregs of the market, but understanding pricing, understanding valuation in particular neighborhoods is really important in the fourth quarter. Or you could get really lucky and see a house that's actually worth buying, offer low, And a seller that's been dealing with this for 6 months might finally capitulate and say, you know what? I just want to be done. I want my money in something else. I've been dealing with this agent I don't like for 6 months, a year, and my family members want to sell it, whatever it is. Their life is on hold until that property is sold. And so we've often negotiated fantastic deals in the fourth quarter. And you should at least look for that, but I wouldn't necessarily expect it given that it is the dregs, in so to speak, of the market. I shouldn't call it that. They're still great houses. We just put one under contract. That's one of our listings. That's an amazing house. So it's homes that have been overlooked, have not gone under contract. It's not the dregs of the market. I should reframe. It's not really what it is.
Yeah. There's also, you know, the kind of, I don't know if it's necessarily group psychology, but you know, when the iron is hot, suddenly everybody's a lot more motivated to jump on a property versus slower market when you do have the time to conduct your due diligence and kind of be more selective. People are much less willing to pull the trigger.
It's a funny habit. It's social proof. It is something that humans cannot get away from. And so herd mentality takes over. And if most people are being cautious, odds are you'll be cautious too. And if most people are being reckless, odds are you'll be reckless, just because of how we are conditioned for social proof.
Right. I'll say I am very glad that I purchased a home at the middle of this year, considering my strategy was to wait for this time of the year and try and find a deal. Considering rates, I would have vastly less buying power at this point and be priced out of a lot of possibilities. So, yeah.
So how should you think about it if you're a seller for next year or a buyer for next year? I think like Hamish took on it with his home, it was an opportunistic strategy. Even though you, Hamish, didn't plan on buying midsummer, you were willing to wait for the fourth quarter. You found what you wanted midsummer, and it's a fantastic house. And it's a home that you're now working to improve, and your attention has shifted. So opportunistic in my mind is, for buyers, is get your listing alerts set up, figure out who you're working with, make sure you trust them, and then start to see inventory, start to see homes, get to understand the market conditions. And that way you really know what you want when it shows up on market, because the last thing you want to have happen is it's your first weekend of looking at homes and you don't really understand the market and you fall in love and you're like, oh, let's just buy it without having done your homework on pricing or neighborhoods or anything. It's a recipe for it's a high risk recipe.
Yeah. Maintain discipline and take your opportunities, not your chances.
Yeah. And for sellers, it's a different game. This is the time of year, fourth quarter, where you want to, again, choose the agent you trust, interview a few, and make sure they're competent. Ask them detailed questions around how they market. What's the budget for marketing? What's the approach for videography and photography? What's the distribution channels that they're going to employ in addition to the MLS? If they say, we're just going to put it on thousands of websites, including Remax and Zillow and Redfin, that's normal distribution. Yeah. That is what every agent should be doing. That's a given. Ask them what else they're doing and how much they're spending and how they're doing it and what's their approach if the home doesn't sell in 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, and how you're going to know if they're doing anything. Those are the important questions to ask if you're choosing agents. So choose the agent you feel comfortable with, and then you should get to work on the recommendations they make to you to improve your home so that it's ready to list when you're going to be ready to move. And that could be January, February, March. So this is the time of year to prep first quarter listings. And that's the meetings we're having with our sellers. We're having meetings with buyers too, but that's the sell side. It's all about listing prep for next year.
And it's a great time to begin thinking about listing next year, because you have, I wouldn't say so much time, but you have enough time to kind of wrap your head around the potential repairs you need to make. You can price shop different contractors and you can begin to look more into the future at a more comfortable rate.
Yep. If you're our client, we'll talk about pre-inspecting, the pros and cons, and I'll pay for it if you choose to pre-inspect your home. But that gives you a list of recommendations, areas that need attention. And like Hamish said, you can choose your contractor. And nobody ever says, oh no, you chose not the gold-plated plumber to change your hot water heater. All they care at that point is the hot water heater got changed or the roof got replaced. They don't even ask about the quality of shingles. It's sort of startling. But if you wait mm-hmm. for the inspection process, guess what they want? They want the top tier shingles. They want the most expensive hot water heater. They want the most expensive plumber with the best marketing that may not be better than any other plumber. And you end up costing yourself a lot of money for things that are likely to come up on inspection. So there's lots of reasons to pre-inspect. There's some not so great reasons either, meaning that you shouldn't. There are arguments for why you shouldn't pre-inspect. I'll just make, since we're on this topic. I'll just tell you why you shouldn't. So this is the conversation we have with our sellers. Here's why you should consider not pre-inspecting. It creates a due diligence rabbit hole where previously they're just in love with the home. They love the light. They love the layout. They're feeling the emotional intensity. And you circumvent that when you give them the inspection report at the first showing, and they have no skin in the game when they run off and look at that inspection report and terminate on the basis of it. Versus if you allow the natural process of the sale to unfold, they go and see the home, they fall in love with it. In theory, they're only looking at homes that they're qualified for and that suit their family in terms of bedrooms and baths and location. So all of the basics, the buyer's agent should have already figured out. But then once they've had a few days, you've negotiated a price, hopefully in a good negotiation that makes them want the home even more. Hint, hint, you don't accept the first offer ever. You make it a little harder. That increases desire in the contract, in the deal. You want something if somebody is being a little difficult about giving it to you. Like you don't, that's a whole nother topic for negotiation. But then
we broach that too.
That's right. And then they hire their inspector of their choice. They spend $1,000 on due diligence costs. They get the inspection report. And now they find out the home has got some issues. Hopefully they're just minor. And the inspector and the realtor connect them with tradespeople that can fix these things at relatively inexpensive costs. Maybe there's an inspection negotiation over these things that were unexpected. I mean, I have rules for that. If it's not visible to the eye and is a defect that was hidden, and it's serious to the health and safety or systems of the house, like the electrical, the plumbing system, the roof, that's fair game. You should expect a roof at half life. You should expect a furnace at half life. Plumbing systems to be at least half life. But if it's something other than that, then it's fair game to negotiate some sort of concession. But now the whole point of bringing this up was because that increases the adhesion in the deal, the glue in the deal. They're emotionally attached at this point. And going back to the fray of looking at homes and being disappointed, the pain of spending all this time on nights and weekends, and most people don't like this. Some people are really into it, by the way, which is fascinating, but most people after a few months of looking at homes are sort of tired of this. So the negative cost of going back to the market is significant. So they're usually more likely to complete the deal. So there's various pros and cons. If you pre-inspect, you increase trust and transparency, but you also decrease deal adhesion, if you will. There's probably a technical term that psychologists would use, but that's the term I'll use right now.
That's pretty solid, yeah.
Yeah. If you allow them to inspect, you potentially get a surprise. You get extorted on inspection items, potentially. They could still terminate, and now you have a potential tainted listing that could have been solved by a contractor at a very inexpensive price. So we let our clients make the decision on whether to pre-inspect or not. Obviously, I feel like I'm a believer at the same time, and so much so I'm willing to pay for the inspection cost, but it's not a free, easy decision where it's black and white. There's nuance to this decision, and
it's a large amount of the the variability of the success of a pre-inspection, I think, comes down to the maturity of the buyer or the experience of the buyer. If they're fresh, I think they're more likely to be suspicious of a pre-inspection than a seasoned buyer seeing a pre-inspection and going, oh, okay, you know, this is actually quite helpful.
It depends on the experience of the buyer. It depends on the experience of the buyer's agent, because there are companies in town that offer pre-inspections that are the same companies we recommend for the inspection if we represented the buyer, right? So I'm not going to name them, but there are a handful that we trust to do a reasonably good job in the inspection process. If that's where the pre-inspection report is from, I would say it's got merit. If it's from somebody's cousin that did the inspection and it's written on a napkin, probably not. And the quality of the report, the detailedness of the report, that also matters. And unless your buyer's agent has experience in the market and has been doing this for a significant amount of time and has their principles and values in the right place, they can easily misguide you on the value of the pre-inspection report. So we always recommend, if you actually the same inspectors we use for the buy side, if you use them for the pre-sale inspection, I'll pay, no problem.
At closing.
At, well, that's because, Hamish, and I appreciate you bringing that up. Let's keep us honest. The reason that's compensated at closing is because if something happens with the seller and they decide they don't want to sell the home, or the market turns out to not be there, it's an unsuccessful listing, they terminate our contract, we're done. We need a way to be paid for that. And that's really the only time we are paid as a brokerage is at closing. We don't work for fees on an hourly basis. Maybe that'll change at some point in the future, but that's how the model works today, is paid at closing. So
yeah, there you have it. I think it's reasonable. Maybe this ties into one of the next talking points, but we just heard from an inspector yesterday who is implementing a pay at closing system in their company as well.
Yeah, I don't think any of our clients need that, but for certain price ranges, that makes sense, right? Where people are like, well, just deal with it at closing. But he did say he takes a credit card because if you terminate the deal, he's still getting paid.
Yeah, they still, absolutely need some sort of assurance, right?
I mean, if you want quality, pay for it. It's like your mama said, don't expect a free lunch for anything in life. All right, last piece in the news. We just completed the Hearth and Stone house tour. And I haven't talked about that, I don't believe, on this podcast. Do you recall me talking about Hearth and Stone?
If only it's in passing, yeah.
Okay. So Hearth and Stone is a luxury broker-only tour that is that exists here on the Front Range. They were about to launch pre-COVID, and then COVID hit, and they shut it down. Once COVID was over, the founders of Hearth and Stone reached out to me and asked me if I'd like to be on their advisory team. And I sat down with them to talk about what it was, and once I understood what they were trying to do, it was a strong yes. And I'm on their advisory team. I don't have an equity position. I just think it's such a great idea that I want to help support it and support other agents with things that help our business and help us be smarter. And that's what the Hearth and Stone Brokerage Tour is, the luxury home tour. And so if you are a licensed agent up here and you are in the luxury segment of the market, you should consider joining Hearth and Stone. And here's what it is. Once a month, we get together and we tour a handful of houses as brokers together, cross brokerages. So it's not specific to House Einstein or Keller or Compass. We have agents from any brokerage, and every brokerage so far have been part of it. And you get feedback from these agents that tour the home. The feedback is delivered via Google form and it's anonymous. So the agents aren't worried about anything personal in providing this feedback. And that feedback is with regards to pricing, staging, home preparation. We also award a best in show of the homes that we tour. If you are a seller, one of the advantages of working with an agent that's in network of Hearth and Stone is that they can potentially get your home on the tour. They can't guarantee it. It has to meet certain criteria and price range, architecturally significant, needs to be updated inside for the most part. Sometimes we have homes that are luxury that are not updated, but that's the idea, is that these are upper tier homes at the luxury segment of the market here in Boulder. And you're getting fantastic feedback as a seller. And if you've chosen a Hearth and Stone agent, you can also potentially get your home on the tour to get this feedback. And there's a whole bunch of social media marketing that goes with it. And as an agent, yesterday I met Kelly Adderidge, and I apologize, Kelly, if you're listening to this podcast. She works with Patrick Dolan, and she's worked with Patrick Dolan for many, many years here in Boulder. And we've done many deals with Patrick and his team. And often I'm interacting with Kelly because she's very fast on the emails. And I've never met her before. I think we've done 5 deals together and I've never met her. And she was on the tour this week. And we actually got to meet and have face-to-face interaction, which increases trust. There's a reason that the Chinese chairman is visiting San Francisco and met with Joe Biden yesterday. Chairman Xi, I'm probably mispronouncing his name. But that reason is because face-to-face interaction always increases trust and builds relationships, from low-level deals all the way to international politics and global superpowers. It's important to know who your counterparties are and establish a human connection. It makes everything go smoother. And so that's the hidden reason to join the Hearth and Stone tour if you are an agent and if you're a buyer or seller, to ask about it. And ask why, if your agent's like, what is that? You can explain it and ask if they would be part of it. And again, I have no financial incentive for pitching Hearth and Stone. I just think it makes so much sense in the community, the real estate brokerage community.
Yeah. Excellent for building relationships. And not to mention, you then get feedback from agents you otherwise wouldn't, because not everybody has a client specifically looking in that sector at that time. Though most, if not all, of these agents are experienced and can provide some excellent feedback.
That's right. And it's organized. They go through the process of selecting the home. So our entire company went yesterday. We had a really fun time connecting with each other, broke bread, had some food. And we could do these tours ourselves, but the time it takes to organize it across brokerages is significant. And so this is an automated process that brings us together with people that share some of our values. It's sort of a no-brainer. I feel like I don't know why we even need to sell it. You will see some Hearth and Stone content every now and then on our socials, and that's what Hearth and Stone's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. So, well, neither of the sales of the week drawn to it. We were planning on including one of the Hearth and Stone houses that we toured yesterday, though can't do that while it's still listed.
Yeah, until Hamish reminded me of the rule. And the rule is we're not allowed to talk about active listings in a way that potentially is negatively perceived on a social media platform like this podcast. We can't put up a billboard that says this house sucks, here's why. The only place we can talk about active listings constructively and critically is on our newsletter. And the reason the newsletter, we can do that there, is because it is for our clients and it is for our prospective clients. And you have to sign up for it. And we're now shifting gears with the newsletter, I should add. We're now publishing that once a month. So really, if you're a client and you're active in the market, call us. The newsletter is way too slow, but we would want to get you on listing alerts and talk to you directly. But when it comes to active listings, we can't say anything about them publicly on this podcast. So we're going to talk about closed deals of the week. We're going to talk about two of them that are recent closings that I think are very interesting deals, are worth a discussion. So if you can choose your favorite website, most of you will probably just go to Zillow. But you can go ahead and pull up the two listings that I want to touch base on. The first one is 250 South 38th Street. So this listing is a basic Martin Acres ranch. And there's quite a few of this one technically. No, it is Martin Acres. There's quite a few of these properties in South Boulder. Actually, all of Boulder is dotted with these ranches from the 50s and 60s. They were a very popular style of home back then. There were a number of builders, but there are so many of these houses that about 10 years ago, I decided to go ahead and create an index to track the Martin Acres home, because that's the base model, right? Like that's the sort of mid-entry level. And I say mid-entry because it's not the entry. Baseline is usually perceived as one step down in neighborhoods in terms of valuations for the same house. Martin Acres is a little more family, a little fewer college students and rentals, and a basic 3-1. Is what I've used as an index measure until it got so thinly traded. There's so few of them that it doesn't make sense to update this that often. But I still look at the homes that qualify for the index. And this particular house is close. It has two bathrooms instead of one, but it does have a one-car garage. It's under 1,200 square feet. It's right at 7,000 square feet in terms of its lot size. And it was built in 1956. So 100%, other than the extra bathroom, which you could adjust for, it matches the index characteristics. And it just sold for $775. And if you look at the photos, you can see it's had a few updates. The windows are not original. The floors totally need to be redone. The kitchen is original. Those are the birch. I think that's birch wood. Cabinetry. They squeezed in a dishwasher at some point. That big space to the left is either for a fridge or it's for the washing machine. That's normally where people put those in this style of home. And it's really, I mean, it's a really basic house with some basic updates. And you can see the little half bath. That's off of the primary bedroom. And it's a home that has served many, many families for decades here in Boulder. And it sets the curve, if you will, of basic entry-level house all the way up to many millions of dollars here in Boulder. And so a lot of people will buy these houses because they are a good entry point to the market. You can raise a family if you follow the small is beautiful lifestyle. You can also add a second story. Usually the most desirable ones have a basement. because that gives you a bigger floor plan to start from. But this is an excellent example, and it's closed for $775, which is exactly the list price, the last list price. It was on the market 52 days. And actually, no, they started at $775. They never changed the price because that price made compelling sense. So a little under 2 months on market, a buyer locked it down and it sold for $775. The seller did contribute some money, probably to buy down the rate in terms of closing costs. They paid $1,300 to buy down the rate. And as far as location goes, this is a quieter spot in Martin Acres. It's not the most desirable street, in my subjective opinion, but it's a great street. It's right around the corner from the park. It's very close to the elementary school. You're sort of in the middle of the neighborhood, which gives you some sound insulation from Table Mesa, Broadway, and US 36. And that's one of the biggest complaints about the neighborhood, is you're very close to high traffic noise. This is right sort of in the middle. And
sort of surrounded.
Yeah, so sort of surrounded. It would be better if it was parkside, but then you could probably add 5% minimum to the price if it was backing to the open space. And was it in the flood zone? It was not in the flood zone, at least on the MLS, although it is pretty close to the creek. It's outside the flood zone. So $775, and buyers had almost 2 months to lock it down and negotiate the concessions that the buyer's agent did. And it looks like a nice clean closing and a fantastic addition of owners to the neighborhood. And if you're interested in the if you're interested in the Martin Acres Index, you can jump into, you can just Google it. You'll probably find some of my old blog posts about the Martin Acres Index. Yep. Sorry, Hamish, I interrupted you.
A little bit of updating this year too, with our intern Grant.
Really, oh yeah, he did look at that too. Yeah, he did. That's right. Thanks, Grant.
Forever in our thoughts.
Anything? Yeah, well, definitely part of the team. If he's here next week, you should, you know, get a beer with him or something.
I don't know if he's of age, but I'll make a note.
You can hand him a glass of Ovaltine while you enjoy an adult beverage, or get him a mocktail.
Ovaltine.
All right, so anything else to add about this house?
Not too much. The description does mention it's got an updated electrical panel, which is one of those, I wouldn't necessarily call it a gotcha, but it's not really in the front of people's minds. And Boulder just voted on, did they vote on it, or is it being floated, the gas range policy, and then the whole kind of societal shift towards home electrification, seeing
I'm not sure
electrical
if
panels kind of a nice.
It's definitely nice. That definitely costs money. And I think the city is moving to all electric very soon if they haven't already approved it. I think they may have. And it just makes sense getting gas out of the home. There'll be people that hold on to it and fight you on it and say, no, 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 we want gas. We want to burn combustion products in our home. It's a fire risk. It's a health risk. It's all these reasons to not do it. And
it's also volatile in price. You know, from just an economic standpoint, it makes less sense at this point.
The other thing to note about this listing, if it's available to you, is the SPD. And the seller did a great job of disclosing. So we were just talking about this with another listing that literally, I was talking about this with buyers, it literally had nothing on the SPD. They just signed it and filled in zero. And which raises more red flags than anything else. But this particular seller went into detail. They talk about roof replacements. They disclose that the washer overflowed and they had to make some repairs. And there was a leak from the kitchen vent and they had to replace the roof. And they went with class 4 impact resistant shingles. And you know, there's all this detail in here that you would expect to see in a proper disclosure. And that increases trust and transparency. I mean, the home got a new furnace in January, and they didn't go with the cheap furnace. They went with the R96, the 96% efficient furnace, right? Like, so there are a lot of things that, to my eye, would point to a home that, even though the kitchen isn't updated, there's a lot of things in this home that have been improved, include, you know, a new sewer line, a clean out.
Oh, that was done. Nice.
They spent $9,000 on fixing the sewer line. You know, all of that stuff is meaningful. And in the long run, it's cheap to fix a kitchen. It's really painful to have to undergo an emergency sewer line replacement, which can often be two times the amount of what it would cost you if you planned for it. But that's another topic.
And while the facts aren't all in on this property, right? Like, we haven't seen it in person, The kind of phrase good bones comes to mind, right? Where it's the functional heart of the home has been maintained and cared for. Sure, there's cosmetics, but as long, those big ticket items have mostly been taken care of. That's a nice positive to see.
100% agreed. And even though I did not walk into this home in particular, I have seen every flavor of Martin Acres Ranch, all the models. I could tell you which ones
I
are easy
believe
to
that.
remove the wall and which ones you have to put in a structural beam. And I could tell you that they're not all the same. The ones that were loved and maintained are worth more money as a for good bones than the ones that were just run into the ground. And there are many of those.
I think final thing, you mentioned sewer, these 50s ranches, you mentioned this even in the newsletter just now. They typically cast iron sewer lines that have what, a lifespan of 60 to 70 years?
I've been told 50 to
Around about.
75 years.
Yeah. So
That's
that's a nice thing to see sorted.
absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you're looking at a home like this, you should be talking to your buyer, or if you're a buyer yourself, you should be aware of cast iron service life and build it into your expectations for acquisition for maintenance things you'll have to address once you own the property. Sorry, I sound a little distracted because I'm moving ahead to the next property. Are you ready, Hamish?
Yeah, get after it.
Okay. The next one's the other end of the spectrum. So we talked about sort of the basic entry-level house in Boulder, the Martin Acres Index qualifying ranch that sold for $775. And now let's talk about 801 Circle Drive, which finally closed at 6.2. Oh, no, hold on. No, they closed for 5 point, just under 6 million. So pull up a map, 801 Circle Drive. There is a little pocket of very high-end homes with amazing views on the southwest side of town, just below Flagstaff Road. And it's preferable, by the way, to not have your entrance on Flagstaff. I'm going to get in trouble with a friend who owns an amazing home on Flagstaff Road, but it's the truth is the truth. If you had an option to not have your driveway on Flagstaff, you would take it. And this home has these killer views. Christmas Tree, Circle Drive, to a lesser extent, Park Lane, all of these streets encompass this little pocket neighborhood that is described as Flatirons Park, and that might be the original subdivision. And this particular house is very large. It's an eight, well, for Boulder standards, it's an 8,000 square foot house built in 2000. So 23 years ago, this home was built before smart regs limited home sizes. It's also sitting on a half acre lot. Some of these homes, by the way, Hamish, and we can look this up later, are actually in unincorporated Boulder County, not in the city, which has a whole other regime of what you can build or not build. So this little pocket corner, depending on where it is, butting up against open space, may or may not technically be in the city. But this one, and if you want to look it up on Boulder, on the tax assessor website while we're working through this, that's fine. That's how you know. But this particular home is unlikely to be buildable again due to its large size, 3-car garage, 5 bedrooms, 7 baths, newer construction, half acre lot, and one of the most premium locations in the city of Boulder, or in Boulder. It may not technically be in the city. So with that said, it's a listing that took a long time to sell. So the listing history shows they hired their first agent in November of 2022, and I don't know why they listed in November. This is one of the worst times of the year to list. We're telling all of our clients you should wait. All you're doing is tainting the listing. You're not going to see a lot of traffic. You might get lucky, but for a home like this, we would have strongly advised you not list until the following year. And nothing happened. They withdrew the listing at the end of December, and they brought it back with a new MLS number, which, by the way, does not erase anything. Same agent, same price, just a brand new MLS number, and looks like a new listing. And just the next day, or actually the same day it expired, they relisted it. So it would look like a fresh listing for January 1st. And it sat on the market again, 5 months, nothing happened. The seller had enough and they withdrew the listing at 5 months. The listing agent said, "I'm not letting you expire the listing. It's withdrawn. You're just going to have to wait then." And so 2 months they waited, during which time they likely interviewed other agents. And then in July of this year, they hired another agent who listed it just below six, which was much more competent. In my opinion, better photography, better marketing. And it was on the market again 3 months. And it eventually they dropped the price from just under six to 5.85. And then 90 days into it, 3 months in, they attracted a buyer. And it just closed at 5.762500, a very specific number. And that was just 3 days ago, was closing. And the reason we brought up this listing is, first, the rarity of this property is something else. I mean, it truly is rarefied air. It's not perfect. There is no perfect location. The steepness of the lot means the backyard kind of drains toward the house. You also are potentially subject to traffic noise from Flagstaff. But other than those two factors, it is just a spectacular spot in town. So I'm a huge fan of that. 8,000 square foot homes are relatively rare to find homes that large and that also accommodate a family, 5 bedrooms, 7 baths, 3-car garage. It's a checklist of what you want. And you're steps away from Chautauqua itself. All of that is really fantastic. I'm not sure what happened with the first listing agent. Clearly, there was some tension there. Some of the broker remarks tell you about how do not contact the seller, that the listing agent still has an active listing agreement and they must be present for all showings, et cetera, et cetera. Oof. And that's a sign of clearly seller was not happy with the performance of their agent and basically withdrew the listing for 2 months until the listing agreement expired. They probably were lawyers involved, but it's true. Once you sign a listing agreement, you are subject to the holdover provision, and no legitimate agent is going to stick it on the MLS until that holdover is expired. And so that's an example of that happening. And we're not going to mention the agents involved, although I will say that the latter agent I have done deals with, and they've gone well, and he's a solid player in the community. And I'm not sure exactly what happened here, but in any event, it was on the market a long time. And if you'd looked at the listing history, you'll see that it's not an uncommon story for this particular property at this particular end of the price range, that they typically don't fly. They're on the market for 3 months or longer before the right buyer comes along. And that's what happened here. Eventually, with the right agent, better marketing, better pricing, the right buyer did come along. It still didn't fly off the market. And I don't know what happened with the first agent. It would have been smarter to price it below six to begin with. It would have been smarter not to list it in November. But other than that, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what occurred. And sometimes those decisions are made because the seller wants to move the house. They don't want to wait to the end of the year. And so if you don't hear pushback, by the way, this is a really good litmus test for interviewing agents. If your agent just tells you what you want to hear, particularly in regards to valuation and the desirability of your home, they don't have constructive suggestions for how to improve it, even from the first meeting. And they're throwing out high numbers and brag about how easy it is for them to sell high-end homes. It's usually BS, and it's telling you what you want to hear, and you're the one that pays the price. And there is a price in terms of lost time, and usually a lower sale price because you started way too high.
So I've got a question for you. I try to give maybe benefit of the doubt, and I don't necessarily know if that's what I'm doing here. Nevertheless, when you're at the higher end of the market, right, where you're talking these price points where potential buyers do have a lot of selection and a lot of capability, essentially, do you imagine that it matters less when you list, or is it still clever to use that seasonal cycle and that swing? I'm trying to think, why would they list so late if it wasn't for a needing to get the cash out of the property or something like that?
We don't know the circumstances of the seller.
Right.
Okay. 100%. I don't know who these people are. So I don't want to suggest that they're going through some sort of family difficulty, but real estate transactions often surround life changes. Maybe they just decided they're done. They're downsizing. They want to move close to their grandkids. Maybe they're getting divorced. Maybe they just got bad advice from an agent that just said, hey, we sell homes year round. Don't worry about seasonality. Let's just get your home on the market. And or maybe they started in May of the previous year with prep and it just took them that long. And they were like, we just need to get this thing on. No one's going to care that it has a tainted listing history. I think that's all a bit of disservice, in my opinion. But we don't know. We don't know the conversations that occurred between the listing agent and their client. So, but I can tell you what is not uncommon to hear, and that is, well, that there's life circumstances and there's agents out there that will tell people what they want to hear. I will say that the new marketing is better. The photography is better. I'm not a fan of fake sunsets, but
the old listing right now.
Yeah, I'm looking at the new listing, and it definitely shows better in these photos. I don't know if that was a massive contributing factor, but one of the things we definitely do with our photos and our video is help clients understand the premium for this location. Mm-hmm. Because people that really know Boulder neighborhoods sometimes wait years. Actually, often wait years for the right home in the right location to become on market. And that's why sometimes you see these really high-end homes fly, and often in a bidding war, because buyers that are in the know understand that this is probably their only shot to ever buy in this neighborhood. And there may be other homes and other neighborhoods that are equivalent, but if this is what they want, you might be waiting another 5 years for the neighboring house to come up, or this home, 10 years for this home to come back.
No, and that lead photo is truly gorgeous, you know, nestled there beneath the Flatirons. That's a pretty one.
Yep. And these people spend some money. Hamish, the kitchen looks great. Even though it's a home that's 23 years old, you can turnkey move into it and it's not going to embarrass your friends when they come over to visit. It's a lovely property. I don't know about the pink tones in the theater. I don't know why Avon Lady colors were popular back then, but
Avon Lady? I might make a note to search what that means.
Avon person. You don't even know what that means. That's really funny.
No, over my head.
Maybe there's just a gene that, you know, for that kicks on once you hit 60 and you start liking these mauves and pinks and dark purples. I don't really know what happens. It's like at either end of the spectrum, my niece, when she was like 4, everything was hot pink. And my sister did everything she could to not have, you know, cisgendered, stereotypical values. Wow. And she still went for princess, sparkly, and hot pink. And there was no way my sister could stop it. And so maybe it's just genetic expression that happens at either spectrum of life as you hit past 50. I don't know what do you think the equivalent is for cisgendered men?
I don't know.
We start getting ear hair, crazy eyebrows, and I would say, you know, you have the midlife Corvette and
interests. Yeah,
the late life Cadillac. I mean,
go ahead.
Just to wrap up cars, and I don't want to get distracted too much on cars, but the only vehicle I ever saw my father get like annoyed by us using as kids was his Cadillac. As in college, I borrowed it. I can't remember what for, and he got so angry. He was out of the country for some reason. I think we used it to move my sister from, like, we put a trailer on it and used it to tow like her belongings to college or grad school for law school. And he was really annoyed with us. Yeah, because, you know, it's got a big honking V8. And you can hook up a pretty decent sized utility trailer to it. And he got really annoyed with me. And he never got annoyed with any other vehicle I ever used as a child. That one he got attached to. It was very strange.
You might have to follow up with him on that one.
Comes with the ear hair.
Remember that time you got really mad at me? It's always a good way to start a conversation.
Yeah, he won't remember it at all.
One thing, this 801 Circle Drive shares a driveway.
Huh. Yeah. Okay, I mean, that's not a big deal. It means you have an agreement for who... almost certainly these guys are not shoveling their walk, so they have somebody come up and do it and split the cost. If it needs to be repaired, there's an agreement to split the cost. And in the title work, there's an easement for a shared driveway. So just in a little bit of additional due diligence for purchasing. As long as there's reasonable privacy between the homes, a shared driveway is usually a plus. Sort of you're splitting the cost.
Properties. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So interesting. They were all developed at the same time, almost certainly.
It checks out.
Again, things that would be hard to do under today's regulatory regime in Boulder.
I like the term regime. I think it's very fair and balanced.
Does it sound kind of like dictator-like? Like there might be some
opposite. No.
There might be some bureaucracy in our city that keeps things from happening, whether it's affordable housing or high-end stuff. Okay, let's move on. Those are the sales of the week. That took way too long. Next week, we're only going to do one because otherwise we can ramble on and on.
Yeah, it was fun.
Well, one of the things I want to talk about is professionalism in a deal. And I'm not going to mention either of these, although we were both the listing agents on them. And it's just such a pendulum swing. I said,
I like that. Yeah.
Pendulum swing. When you have an agent that exhibits such poor professionalism, and then the very next deal, we're dealing with an agent on the other end of the spectrum who has fantastic communication, who immediately contacts us if there's a concern or question and works on resolution. Like, what can we do to solve this problem? And I don't want to go into any specifics because I can't. This deal is still active and in play, but I just want to say how refreshing it is when we're working with an agent that understands how important professional behavior is, good communication is to getting a deal done. Everything so far has been easy. Knock on wood, it continues to be easy. And even with sometimes challenging problems become far easier when agents on both sides of the deal have good communication and professionalism. So choose wisely who represents you.
Yeah. And not to, there's, I don't think too much more to say though. It does. There's a lot more confidence personally in this deal. And you know, the future is unclear, no crystal ball, though just having that kind of grounded feeling is a nice change.
I told the seller of the other deal we had a 5% chance of closing. I was that lack of confidence. And this one, I would say 65%. We still don't celebrate until closing.
Yeah. And we don't deal in absolutes.
And we don't. You know. We do our best to get the deal done and represent our clients. But this is what the reason I'm bringing this up is really – it ties to the NAR commission lawsuit. It ties to a misguided belief that all agents are the same, that you can click a button and schedule a showing and you're going to get good service, or you just assume you're going to get zero service and agents just collect their 2.8 and do nothing for the commissions. And that misguided belief is one of the biggest mistakes that buyers and sellers make, more buyers than sellers. They just start working with whoever starts showing them houses. And unfortunately, they often... it ends up costing them a lot of money. I don't know how to put it. Listing, a lot of time and money.
Mm-hmm. When that listing sells in North Boulder, if it sells, that'll be a good one for us to talk about.
Okay. I don't know which listing you're talking about, but we'll have to revisit it.
Great. It's that ambiguous. Nobody knows.
Great. Really? I don't even know what listing you're talking about. Fantastic. So remind me when we could talk about it to talk about it. Okay. One of the things, and this was Hamish, your topic was, fame and fortune, respecting sellers and buyers' privacy. How is that handled?
So we were kind of joking, before we started recording this podcast about our personal effects in the background of the podcast and people kind of finding us. And then Osmond, I don't know if you read it or watched it, but came across an article where that actually happened.
Let me tell it. Yeah, that way we can really get to it. It's a horrifying video of a disturbed person who has stalked a child who's 12 years old and has found this child's address. Oh. And their parents put some content online when she was very little, like 6 years old, like doing arts and crafts with a 6 year old. And this person found this on YouTube and has been obsessing over this 6 year old for 6 or 7 years and literally has stalked them, harassed them, even though all the content's off now. I mean, who would ever want to this exposure to your child? Has shown up at the door, preaching all sorts of religious crazy talk and saying that he wants to be with this child. And the police, it's a police video. And so I brought that up just because we were commenting about some of the possessions that we might show in the background. And I don't put a ton of time into it. Mostly it's just camera equipment back behind me. Hamish has some nice art. We've got some sound deadening panels to have better sound quality for you. And we're also adults. So, and I'm an adult male. middle-aged male that doesn't have the concerns that I think a child and unfortunately this is cisgendered thinking, but an attractive female might have by putting out social media content.
Yeah. So that's kind of where this idea stems from. And going forward, I've drafted quite a few listing agreements at this point, considering my exposure to countless deals.
Just a few.
Yeah, within, these 21 months. And there's a few checkboxes. And Osman, I'm sure you'll be able to jump in a little bit, but there's a few fields where it's like, will this address be displayed on the internet? Will you disclose the identity of the sellers? Privacy questions, which I think are generally pretty valid. And I was just curious, I don't want to call it a standard or I don't want to call it a norm, but I have never seen a listing without those details. And that said too, right, public records also include the owners, though you can also have that in a trust if you wanted to increase privacy.
Yep. I lost the second half of what you shared. My screen froze. We had a little bit of a technical blame Elon and Starlink, but I lost the network. What I heard was there's a number of check boxes in the contract, both listing agreement, buy side, sell side, that that pertain to privacy. And things like the address will be displayed on the internet.
Yep. And I haven't seen that in person or heard of a case where that's been utilized. So I didn't want to say that it was the norm that people display their addresses and disclose their identities, though I just haven't seen it before.
And unfortunately, we broke up again. So paraphrase one more time.
This relationship is not working out.
With Elon. That's who we're blaming.
Just essentially, I haven't seen many listings, or I haven't seen a single listing where the address has been obscured or the identities or details of the sellers have been obscured. And I went into public records say that those things, though also trusts can own properties on the public records to further create a bit more privacy.
So I'm not sure why this originated in the contracts. Usually there's a case that got in front of the real estate commission, and then they added this verbiage. And it's been that verbiage for as long as I've been in real estate in Colorado, and has not changed. And I don't know what the case was. But with that said, there are lots of reasons people want to protect their privacy. And there's a recent story with an agent in town 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, Hamish, that the person who bought this pretty high-end home was very, very angry that the newspaper disclosed their identity. And everything, they took great pains to not disclose their identity. They bought it in an LLC. They had an attorney present, did all these things. But unfortunately, they must have missed a step or two, or somebody at the title company leaked it, or somebody at the broker's office leaked it to the media. And it's, I think it was like a $10 or $15 million property, but they just didn't want that to be known for various reasons, that they were buying this high-end home. And people that have earned their wealth, in my experience, are often very reserved at expressing it, and they don't want to be known as people of that much affluence. If you're given the choice between wealth and fame, choose wealth all day long as nobody knows, because you can live a relatively ordinary life and still have affluence. I mean, that's pretty perfect. But in any event, that's another story. The reason they're upset is because their identity was disclosed. And I've never seen a listing where the property address is not disclosed. So here's our normal advice to our clients. If they want to conceal their identity as buyers, we need to get them with title early. We need to make sure that the trust or their LLC is properly set up to minimize the risk of exposure. And we have the right people at our favorite title company to help you do that. If you are a seller, your higher risk is somebody stealing your identity or robbing your belongings. They potentially could also use your garage door opener and get the code with one of those little code scanning devices. They're $20 on a showing. And this is one of the dangers, by the way, of Click to allow people to show property. Like click a button on Zillow and boom, schedule a showing, is that that agent has no relationship with those buyers. And two people show up. One person is distracting the agent. The other person is getting the garage door code. And that stuff was happening quite a bit in the era where meth was being manufactured in vacant homes in the United States. It's less of an issue today. But still, those are the types of privacy concerns that are much more a deal.
Front of mind, so
much more realistic. Jewelry, legal and recreational drugs, high-end art, other valuables, heirlooms, things that you will never be able to recover from if it's taken, should be stored off-site. And you should secure all the financial records. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've done a showing and in the office of the seller, all their legal documents are spread out on a table. It's like, what are you doing? Like, this is so scary that you think it's okay to
too
leave. Your medical bills are sitting there on the table. I'm like, okay, well, like this person has some hefty medical bills. Right? Like, how do you not look
at
five-figure bill sitting on an empty desk? You're like, okay, well, I guess they're motivated as a seller. So that sort of stuff is a much more likely avenue. But if you have privacy concerns, and you should talk about them with your listing agent and with your buyer's agent. Don't assume they're competent. Maybe talk to a title company and an attorney as well. And there are ways to limit your exposure. But there's no free lunch. Even celebrities have struggled with this. The Ramsey House has a whole legal agreement you have to sign before they'll let you see it. You can't take photos. You have to agree. Like we haven't needed to see the
or other Ramsey.
No, the Ramsey House in Boulder is that little girl who was strangled, Hamish, years ago. That's okay. JonBenet.
We were just off of celebrities. My mind was.
Yeah. Otherwise. Unfortunately, her parents became celebrities. It's a story that's horrific, but that has all sorts of privacy rules for entry. So that's where I come down to is have a frank discussion with your agent before you begin showing homes, even before you choose an agent, about their approach.
And then strategically, this is one of, I think, this is any real estate agent's favorite question or any buyer's favorite question. Why are you selling? You know, why is the seller selling? Let's try and see if we can work out a little bit of motivation here and see if we can frame the deal in kind, right? And that's
so. You mean have this question conversation with your seller?
You get that. You know, you're at a showing, and if there's the listing agent present, it's a missed opportunity if you don't ask it.
The listing agent. So there's a couple of flavors of this. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're the seller and I'm the listing agent, and you tell me, Osman, I want to sell my home because I have a mold allergy and this house has had a toxic mold problem and I just can't seem to solve it. Well, you now have created a major problem. First, you should, as a seller, you should be disclosing the mold on your SPD anyway. But guess what? Your listing agent also has to now disclose it because we are required to disclose adverse material facts proactively. That's the key word. And I'm not saying you should hide these things, by the way. Ethically, you should never hide these things. You should fix them and disclose the new tests that show that's the right answer is do the testing, disclose that the house no longer has a mold, fix it. Test it, disclose it. That's the right answer. But if you tell them you have health issues, or how about you tell them this? You're going through a major divorce and you just got to sell the house. Forget about health issues. Now there's nothing material to the house. Now what? Your agent should lie when asked the question. That's what should happen.
There's the thumbnail. Your agent should lie.
Look, it's not a – like if I'm representing the seller, I'm ethically bound and fiduciarily bound to represent their best interests. And even though I don't think I'm a particularly good liar, if it's not a material defect to the house and I know your motivating factor, I'm not going to tell the buy side to come lowball me. I'm going to say, you know, they're moving to Florida. They have some changes going on and they're ready to let go of the house. They've loved living here for all these years. They hope the next buyer does as well. Even if they hate each other and they've been fighting like cats and dogs for the last 10 years, I'm not going to tell the buyer that. Yeah.
You can't let slip, right, that their hands are tied and the seller needs to get out, you know, no matter what. Your fiduciary duty, you'd be doing the sellers a disservice.
My legal and ethical duty as a human being that has been hired by these people to represent them, to sell this asset, is to them. And even if you knock on the door and it is an unrepresented buyer and you say, can I write an offer on this house? That's still a very difficult thing to overcome. And I would frankly say it's impossible. And you should really shy away from transaction brokerage. This is why you really want your own buyer's agent, because they actually are supposed to represent your best interest, not the interest of the seller, and even not their own interests. Yeah, it's a tricky thing, and it requires a nuanced understanding of the law and also clarity on your own personal ethics and values. If somebody discloses something that's adverse material, I have to disclose it.
Yeah.
And not just because it's the law, it's because it's the right thing to do.
No, I just very much enjoy when there is a listing agent present or you're showing during an open house or something. Just, I don't want to call it a charade, but the little bit of theater where it's like, so why is the seller selling? And the listing agent, oh, you know, because, and you're like, oh, okay, so is there room in there? You know, like, how desperate are they?
My favorite is when they tell you things they shouldn't tell you.
That's
like, I call on the phone.
Opportunity comes.
Have you been getting a lot of showings? Is the seller flexible? Those two questions are two of my favorites. And the number of times I hear, no, we haven't had a showing in months, and yes, lowball me, is insane. It's like, I can't believe you just said these things.
Yeah.
Okay.
But thanks. Yeah.
Well, I'm not, and then I'm going to say, well, geez, I'm not sure my buyer's really interested in this home. There are some others they're really thinking about. So we'll get back to you if there's any further questions. Yeah. Thanks so much for the showing. And then I call my client and I'm like, the home you really love, guess what? They haven't had a showing in months, and they're getting ready to just, let's lowball the hell out of it.
Yeah.
Because I represent you and I love a good deal.
And that's where, you know, you say this negotiation starts at the first phone call, first contact.
Yeah. Well, negotiation really actually with our listings now starts with the showing, because I'm attending all of our showings. So I get to see the buyer and their behavior from the moment they walk in the door, from the moment they walk up the driveway, the car they pull up in, their body language. It's so much useful intelligence that it's worth it, especially in a market that's slowed and listings have become harder to sell. We need to work harder for our clients, and that's why we're now doing that.
Mm-hmm. And loop back into what you said about President Xi Jinping and Biden, right? Got to be in person. That's where you get the most details. That's where you get the most nuance.
They're also less likely to submit a lowball if they meet me in person.
Interesting.
And I talk about what kind humans you are and how you work for the Humane Society and you take care of the elderly and you deliver meals on wheels. Guess what they're not going to do? Lowball you, because that feels bad. It's like kicking a puppy or something. Like, you're not going to do it. So it's, or at least it's less likely. All right. So we're now, please don't kick any animals or hurt any animals ever. Okay.
Good,
so with that said, it's an expression. It should be out of our lexicon, but it's still there. All right. Last thing I want to talk about is some updates to our fresh listings and our podcast schedule and some of the other content that we're putting out. So after several months of delay, Fresh Listings is going out tomorrow. And in it, there's a detailed explanation of our value proposition and my thoughts on the NAR Commission ruling. I spent a couple of weeks thinking about it, and this is the conclusion of that, at least how it stands today. So check that out in the Fresh Listings newsletter. And we are playing catch up. I think we already talked about that in our podcast, or in this podcast earlier. We're playing catch up. We're publishing two a week until we're caught up. But our goal, we're going to move our recording to earlier in the week and try to get podcasts out by the end of the week. And our other content is largely around what we're doing in the real estate world, whether it's the Hearth and Stone luxury home tour or showings or meeting listing appointments with sellers. If we have time, we'll make some content around that. But we don't spend most of our time making content. We spend most of our time helping our clients buy and sell. And that's always our priority, is serving them.
Yeah, absolutely. Also a big, I think, distinction between the way our content's going now is we are trying to provide at least some level of insight or value to each piece of content. It's no longer, look at this, we sold a house. It's, we sold a house and here are some challenges, or we sold a house and here's what went great. We're trying to contextualize a little bit more, and sure hope it's enjoyed.
Well, it's kind of strange, okay? But when I was a kid, there was a suit store in New York City, and I was like 10 or 12, and its tagline was like an educated consumer is our best customer. I think that's what it said. And basically they were trying to educate you on the valuation of suits and how inflated these suits are in department stores and custom tailored shops. And if you went to this suit store, you could get the same suit. We would 24 to 48 hours, we'll custom tailor it to you and it'll be half the cost. And we want to educate you as a consumer of men's fashion mostly, although I think they had women's too. This is childhood memories. So they had these couple of big warehouses in New York filled with suits and women's clothing too, I believe. And the prices were so good that my frugal, value loving family would literally drive there to buy, like, once every 2 years, my dad would buy his suits from there. And in fact, I still have a suit from there in my upstairs closet that my parents bought me when I was 16. That's kind of scary. It did. Yeah. It did. So in the back of my head, I feel like that influenced me and the House Einstein brand. I respect our clients. I know how smart they are. And I don't want to insult their intelligence, but there's a lot to learn about the real estate industry and about real estate transactions and about home purchasing and selling and selection and all the things we talk about. So the simple tagline, our mission is to help you make a smarter real estate decision, is what we're about. And it's based on that. I love educated people. And so our content increasingly reflects that. It reflects a desire to educate and show you the difference in what we do compared to our competition.
Those are the updates.
That's it. I think that's the end of podcast 26. And yes, we deeply appreciate you listeners. All the feedback has been fantastic. If you are looking for us, you will find us at houseeinstein.com. My phone number is there. The best way to reach me personally is just to call. You will almost certainly get voicemail. Leave a message. Tell me what the call is about, and I will call you back. That is become – we're back to old school because of all the text messaging and all the emails that my inbox gets gets hit with.
It worked. It was good.
Yeah. So call me. Call me maybe.
All right. And with that, have a great day.
Okay. Thank you. Have a great day. Bye.